saying, did you ever treat Mr. Plaintiff before? And if so, what was the matter with him? What did he tell you? And in effect, they didn't ask that. They said, send your records to be copied. Absolutely legal. Dr. Lifshitz refused. This is a sin against the Holy Ghost. You do not lightly refuse subpoenas from lawyers. So he was cited for contempt. I mean, he was given a lot of, you know, attempts to persuade him to do the right thing, and the reasons were all explained to him as I've explained them to you. Dr. Lifshitz refused. Dr. Lifshitz even refused to say whether or not he'd ever treated this man, whether or not he'd ever seen him. This became a cause célèbre, because Dr. Lifshitz stood not alone. He got a great deal of support from the rest of the psychiatric community. What he said was, in effect, that if under any circumstances I breach this patient's right to privacy, then other patients, not only this patient might be harmed, don't give a damn about him any, really, but other people may feel that their private communications to me might, in certain circumstances, be made public, and therefore, not only will their care be inhibited, but also a proprietary right of mine will be harmed. My business will go down, which is a very real thing for doctors. Well, this went up to the highest court in California, which did not slap, well, it slapped him down, but it slapped him down very gently. It recognized that Dr. Lifshitz was propounding a very serious, very important social, medico-legal issue. He asked for certiorari to the court, the United States, the Supreme Court of the United States, and they treated it in the way that they treat so many of them. Denied is put on by the clerk who opens the mail. But in any event, Dr. Lifshitz was ordered to hand over the information to the judge, not the usual way at all. And the judge would then look at the record to see what portions might conceivably be relevant to this lawsuit. And only those portions of the record would be handed over to the defense lawyer. What is the purpose of all this preamble? Privacy, the right to privacy, is very deeply enshrined now in the law. It's quite a new concept. It's a matter of less than 50 years that one has a right to privacy in one's own personality. It may be that this concept to many of you in the audience is almost unknown. Many of you, I'm sure, have high security clearances, which means that your private lives are repeatedly looked over by governmental and quasi-governmental bodies. And many of you may well feel, if you don't have anything to hide, what do you have to be so reluctant about? However, the law looks at this rather differently, and I think so does a great deal of the mass of society. Now, with this in mind, I cringed at this idea of one number being given to every person so that that will follow you through life, your medical record number or whatever you choose to call it. Where this seems to me to be of importance medico-legally is not so much in the input, notice how quickly I learned the words, but in the problem of the storage. Take the ordinary physician, or even take the hospital, but it's easier to see it within the concept of the physician-patient relationship. The physician has the medical records in a file, which he keeps in the closet in his office, and when they get too many, he puts them down in the basement, or if that becomes filled, they're put into boxes, and they're sealed with sealing tape, and they're given to the beacons, or whoever does the storage. And the same thing, in effect, is done in the hospital, except there they use these more exotic methods of putting it onto microfilm or onto microfiches, and a dot will have 17 patients' records or whatever. But essentially, however that is done, is really only a variant of having it stored at Beacons or the United Van Line. And then along comes you people and talks about putting it onto computers. Well, this is all good and fine, it seems to me, when we're storing data which seems to be fairly neutral in significance. But it seems that there are other items of medical information which I would really want to have stored most carefully. For example, whether or not I flunked my serological test for syphilis. This is something I really want to be kept quite confidential. Or whether or not I went to the doctor talking about some really quite bizarre marital problem. Or that I might be a homosexual, overt or latent. Now, these really are things I don't want people to know about. Now, you put all this, I take it that Wisconsin could devise a series of questions which would explore that very fully. Maybe they have. But what I want to know is what happens to the data and who has access to it. It seems clear that the mass of the commonalty, such as myself, has great doubts as to whether or not you people are to be trusted to keep this stuff really secret. You have shown in the past in more general items that you are not. You sell my stuff from the Department of Motor Vehicles to various organizations that will then try and sell me radios on my credit card. Or as soon as a baby is born and they get that information from some Bureau of Vital Statistics, I will get stuff in the mail. Do I want to buy a layette or a crib or something like that? So on the simple level, you have shown somewhat less than that inviolate trust that maybe the patient has the right to require. Now, this is on a commercial basis. Suppose we get some arm of government, and all of you people, I take it, have to be as buddy-buddy as you can with the government, from whom all blessings flow. And the government comes along and says, we'd like a readout of how many complaints there were to doctors in the last year in the city of Sunnyvale by homosexuals, for example. That's easy. I mean, with all the data stored at the hospitals and the doctor's offices, I take it your apparatus could read this out in a matter of seconds or minutes. And the next stage, of course, equally simple, I take it, is to read out the names. This seems to me to pose the Lifshitz problem most acutely. It is more likely that the doctor will die in the breach to prevent the breach of privilege than will the machine. Now, I asked at the El Camino Hospital, supposing I come in and I want to play with the machine, how do I find out how about Dr. Schmo's patient? Well, you can't do that because he has a code number. So I said, well, how do I find out his code number? I thought, because it's always been the way in the past, it was going to be a book in some room where I could just go and read the code number. Apparently there isn't that. You really have to find it. But I'm sure you'd all agree with me that any determined person could find out any code number in 10 minutes of hard work. So now the El Camino system, which is, I'm told, very advanced, it's just the greatest, it isn't at the moment telling much. It is, however, telling lab data. And lab data comes back to our old friend, the serological test for syphilis. So I could find that. So the problem of data storage seems to me intimately bound with the possible assault on the right to privacy. I'm not talking about all the stuff that was in the Congress about you're going to know everything about everybody and what their rates of pay are and how many children they've got. This seems to me a great deal more diffuse. Philosophically, you can argue that it is 1984 right now, but I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in the more bread and butter problems of these very sensitive communications between a doctor and a patient on matters which could be the source of public obloquy. This bothers the heck out of me. That's part one. Part two is the thing on which hopefully I might make a lot of money, which is always one of my motivating forces. And that is in the problem of what is called tort law. Tort law is the method by which the civil law resolves civil conflicts between two people. you rear-end me in the automobile, that you have committed a tort against me, and I sue you in a court of law in a civil suit. Let us take a computerized problem. It is my understanding from reading the best medical publications, Time, Newsweek, things like that, that there is a now fairly well-recognized technique for the computerized interpretation, for example, of electrocardiograms. And if I understand the technique in its most simple form, the computer is programmed with all kinds of abnormal electrocardiograms. And along comes the GP in Boondocksville, Iowa, and he merely puts the electrodes onto the patient. It is the results are transmitted over a telephone line to the computer, which promptly reads back, this is bundled branch block, take two aspirins and call me tomorrow, or whatever it is. Supposing, horrible thought, that the computer has been programmed incorrectly. Or supposing, and I don't know whether or not this is anathema, that the thing doesn't work properly. And that instead of calling up the response or printing out the response that this is an obvious grave abnormality, it prints out that this electrocardiogram is normal. And the patient thanks the doctor, walks out of the door, and drops dead. And then the relatives come to see me and say, let's have a lawsuit. And then I look around about whom do you sue? Is it the physician who very properly relied upon the data which was printed out to him? Is it the programmer, a person, I suppose, of small means? Is it the is it the manufacturer? Is it the person who devised the program? I mean, the physician who set it in train. This worries me quite a bit. I'm sure I would go against the Lockheed or the Burroughs Company or something like that, but it does raise some very interesting problems in tort law. The minute you interpose this kind of complicated machinery, now I recognize that I'm open to the argument, well, machinery is being used all the time. Dr. Lamson, I think it is, in his lab, a great deal of his routine work now is being done by machinery. I think this is true, but it seems to me that that machinery is capable of a little bit more day-to-day watching, a little bit more day-to-day control than your massive thing with blinking off and on lights down at the Lockheed Space Center or whatever, wherever they have it. And the idea of the crucial diagnostic test being performed by a very anonymous machine does give me, as a tort lawyer, a certain amount to think about. To the extent that, for example, that this very complicated and very I was most interested in this problem of history taking. Supposing it reads the damn thing out wrongly. It takes in all the input correctly and they press all the right buttons and it goes wrong at the end. Who is responsible? Is it the university? Is it the machine manufacturer? Or, as I say, the programmer or the person who made the typewriter that prints it out? I really don't know. But it seems to me a field, from a lawyer's point of view, a field that must be explored with the greatest amount of care. If you're committing people's well-being to this machine, somebody has to be materially responsible for it. Somebody's got to say, it's my baby, if it's wrong, I'm at fault. Because remember, a principle of tort law is you have to be able to point to somebody and say, you wronged me, or I allege that you wronged me, and I'm going into the courts to seek redress. After all, that's what we have the civil law for. I'm not sure, by the way, how important this will be. I take it that eventually you will be able to produce machines which are foolproof. I spoke to the man, by the way, at Stanford, who is a fellow in law and computer science, and he told me that some of his computer colleagues say that you can make machines that will have so many internal controls that they will correct themselves, and it is impossible. They allege you can make the computer absolutely infallible. He told me that as far as he was concerned, this was utter hogwash. I have no way of telling one way or another. I take it in a group as prestigious as this, the answer will be that they are infallible. I just don't know. However, I don't think that this is going to be the most critical area. The critical area is the area that I began with and the area with which I'm going to end. It seems to me that the privacy problem is the crucial problem. The fact that the most secure, the most important aspects of my personality is going to be recorded on data which theoretically, anyway, is available to anybody that knows the key. We saw that in the lawsuit in Palo Alto. Some guy knew what you do to read into somebody else's computer. Seems to me vital. Supposing I was being considered for some position and along the federal government could come and read out that I have done thus, thus, and that. This seems to me something that you cannot gloss over lightly. And until you can show that your privacy is 1,000% and that nobody is going to have access to it other than with appropriate legal process, I, for one, would be most reluctant to see data stored from patients worldwide or nationwide with all kinds of strangers, people who have certainly not my permission, access, as I say, to the most vital aspects of my own personality. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Gampel. Well, in addition to being, I think, an extremely interesting session and a challenging one, we have also managed to stay on time. We now have the 30 minutes left for the question session. I would like to have you stand and give your name. Do we have floor mics? We have floor mics. Stand and give your affiliation if you can, and address your question to one of the speakers by name, please. A gentleman right here.
Gordon Dower from Vancouver. I should confess I am a doctor as well. I'd like to pose a question to Dr. Gamble. Surely the question of privacy, which he concerns himself at the moment, applies generally to a hospital now, where almost any of the employees in a hospital could, if they so strove, obtain information about any of the patients. There's the stenographic pool and so forth.
I'm sure, are these things live? Good. That, of course, is true. In any doctor's office, when you come along and say, well, the problem is I've got syphilis, that is then recorded on the doctor's records by his stenographer. And in the hospital, the typing pool has it, and so on. However, I think by your very control of your employees, you instill in them the fact that, look, one of the names of this game is confidentiality. Now, it's true they can go and blow it, but they're only going to do that one time before they're out on their ear. And I'm sure that within your hospital record room in Vancouver or where you are, I don't doubt that the record room librarians, as part of that code that they will get up and recite at every staff dinner they have, one of the things which is part of their very way of life is confidentiality. Now, sure, it can blow. But the problem about yours is that the blowing is almost built into it. That not the people who are part of the setup, but the stranger to the operation can come in. Do you see what I regard as the distinction?
I see a distinction in that sense, but surely it would be much more difficult to ensure security for records locked in the basement or with various people coming in able to see them at odd times and so forth, than to have somebody that's sufficiently cogent to be able to operate a computer and seek the code. It's really a question of how difficult is it, and to what extent would a hospital be negligent if it had taken reasonable pains to make sure that this didn't happen?
As long as the hospital takes reasonable pains, I'm sure it's off the hook. Let me answer your question a slightly different way. Under the law, a communication between a doctor and a patient is privileged. If that communication is made in the presence of a third person, it isn't privileged, because the law says, well, if you didn't mind a third person knowing, then you don't mind anybody knowing. Except if the third person is a person who is necessary to the communication, such as if you're an old lady, your daughter that you bring along to help you, or in the doctor's case, if his nurse is there or his stenographer and so on. That is not a publication. That is part of the team. What I was addressing myself to is not only the person who knows the trick of getting into the computer, but the fact that you computer people tend, for better or worse, to make your data available to people that I don't want it made available to.
There's one other point, which is that the a built-in safeguard with regard to the traditional chart is the illegibility, which is impossible to crack.
Are there any of the other speakers that would like to address that? Dr. Lampson.
Well, after Dr. Slack's comment, I probably ought to keep quiet. But speaking for one hospital, which happens to own its own computer, and the employees who operate it are subjected to the same training as medical record personnel, so that's all even, I feel substantially more happy about my security and data stored in the computer than stuff stored out in the open files.
I think there's the issue is perhaps they're more secure, but once again, it raises your sights. We've had the experience of the welfare agency in our city saying, you now have computer-based medical records on all our welfare patients? Gee, could we have a printout of everybody's record? It's no problem. You say you can do it. Why don't you just send them down to our office? And I think that's the issue. It wouldn't be possible in a traditional medical record for them to think about asking the question. Now we're faced with the issue in a very real sense.
Dr. Slack?
And there's one other point, too, that laws may change. And when a patient communicates information to his doctor, he's doing so with the expectation that this is somehow relevant to his health. And if that information, like the positive Wasserman and so forth, is stored in such a way that if the Justice Department changes or whatever, and all of a sudden that data bank becomes available and everything, that is really a gross injustice, I think, to the patient.
Dr. Lampson.
It might be relevant to this general discussion that when one is on the threshold of a whole new technology, things have to change. I remember well in 1961 when we began to report all the laboratory data and clinical chemistry in the hospital through the computer. At that time, in order to be an accredited hospital, the director of the laboratory, and that time happened to be me, I was required to sign every one of these reports to make it legal. Well, the volume of output and the timing of the output, once we were able to throughput this stuff in an efficient way, this was an impractical requirement. And I had to make the choice, do I just not make progress, or do I just hope for the best and trust that good attorneys like my colleague on my right will help me change the law and go ahead. Well, we had our accreditation visit 2 years later, and they looked at the charts, and no signatures, but my, you can read them. And that was no more said. Never came up again.
All right, we have another question right here.
Dr. Wexler from Pueblo, Colorado. Three questions, one for Dr. Grossman. Television from the Boston airport to Massachusetts General, is it closed circuit? Can anyone else tune in on it? And is it possible to go from the hospital emergency room to the doctor's office, also on closed circuit, to save me running across the street every time somebody comes in with a cat scratch? Item two, Dr. Gamble, what's the possibility of utilizing a central bank for credit so that we can get our credit information more promptly on patients who jump from doctor to doctor? And three, Dr. Slack, how much is the information going to be for the doctor himself to use a computerized control such as Condit system or patient care systems or one of these others versus a teletypewriter printout system?
After that long dissertation, I think speaker should repeat the question. Dr. Grossman?
As to closed circuit TV at the MGH, Dr. Kenneth Bird and his staff have developed a microwave closed circuit TV between our hospital emergency ward and the Logan Airport Station, which the hospital maintains. This allows physicians in the emergency ward to examine patients and interview them in the airport while still remaining at the central hospital. That's all closed. That's a single microwave link, and there's no, it's a fixed directional one, so that that's the only two places that it goes between.
With regard to credit,
I understand that it's not a medico-legal problem. I understand that various methods of computerizing credit information is freely available now. It does, however, turn to the other aspect that I drew your attention to, the problem of mistakes in the computer. You can't even get my damn Diners Club bill right. And I was told repeatedly that was caused by problems with their computer. Even the transmission of credit information has some problems. And remember that the great beef and why we now have certain federal and state legislation about the dissemination of credit information is that all this mass of stuff goes in the computer and is just read right out. The computer has no discrimination. And you get out credit information that some unhappy neighbor of yours said that you beat your wife or you were a drunk or your son was a drunk and so on. And that is all solemnly read out or printed out by the computer. But as for credit being available to doctors, as long as you paid your money to the local retail credit bureau, I'm quite sure that you could have available the same techniques as Penny's does or the Safeway store or anybody else. There's no special medico-legal problems about it.
Dr. Slack, I believe you were on the list for the last question.
Right. I'm not sure I entirely understood. I think I did, but I was wondering if you would elaborate a little bit on the printout.
$6.50 to $10 approximately to have these done by various systems such as Medical Datamation from Denver and such. It takes us 3 to 5 days to get this information printed out for us. Whereas if I take the history myself, I consider it 2.5 to 3 hours. My technician takes it. It takes it 2.5 to 3 hours of her time to get the information that I seek to take care of this patient, except for dire emergencies where they're having a heart attack. I can do that information in 10 minutes. But I need to know all about the rest of the history to comply with hospital records, whether their grandmother had ingrown toenails and so forth.
Well, I think that this is one of the advantages of the interactive computer technique, because immediately upon completion of the computer-acquired history, we can use the information there and generate a printed summary for the physician. One thing that we are building into our systems now is a summary for the patient first, and he will be asked if there's anything he would like deleted from that. And I'm in complete agreement with the dilemma here, and we've spent quite a bit of time thinking about it. And I like the idea of something like a safe deposit system or something like that, where the patient is an essential person in the acquisition of any information, and also the patient should be able to audit his... I think that we ought to make the medical chart a declassified document. This business of having not permitting a patient to read his own chart is a big hang-up in medicine, and if the patient wants to read his chart, he ought to be able to read his chart, and he ought to be able to say, I don't want that in there, if he wants to. And I think... if we could change in this way, it might help.
Thank you. We had one in the back of the room.
Thank you. Rod Steele. I'm at the VA Hospital in Palo Alto and at Stanford Medical School. I'm an instrument-oriented electrical engineer. I'd like to ask a question of Dr. Campbell. And that is, when is do you view the responsibility for the patient's care involve somebody other than the doctor from a legal point of view? It's pretty clear that if you go into the doctor's office and he does a few tests in the office, that he's really the only guy that's involved. The fact that a technician helped him with some of the lab tests and all, he's responsible for their activities and whether they do things right. But the other extreme is where you go into a facility where there's a big computer involved and instrumentation that helps to get the information from the patient to the computer. And from what you said earlier, the doctor has somehow got some associates involved in this who become responsible. You mentioned the programmer and the manufacturer of the computer and a few other people. And sort of in the middle is a situation where you go in and a sample of blood is taken and it goes up to the lab and they do 25 different determinations with an autoanalyzer, and there I guess the pathologist who runs the lab has gotten into the act. And so I'd like to ask, where have we gotten to in complexity, or how complex does the thing have to be that there's somebody, like maybe me, when I design the equipment or set it up, that or the manufacturer of the computer is suddenly involved in this situation, and the responsibility for assessing the possibility of error is no longer the doctor's but somebody else's?
Well, it's a very complicated field of law. I think generally the answer would go something like this. For people who work directly under the doctor, the people with whom he has what the law calls a master-servant relationship, his employees in his own office, his lab technician, and so on, for them he is responsible under the law. They are personally responsible, but he is also responsible under a doctrine called Latin, everything in Latin is obviously okay, called respondeat superior. The master is responsible for the wrongs of the servant. On the other hand, at the other extreme, there is the situation where the doctor is dealing with another as an independent contractor. The other person is an independent contractor. You send your blood out to another lab, which then reports on it. That other lab is an independent contractor. The doctor is in no way responsible for any wrongdoing there unless he negligently selected the independent contractor. If he had a history of there being wrong day after day, then it was negligent on his part to pick them. But other than that, he is insulated from their wrongdoing unless their result is manifestly wrong, that any babe in arms should, or any prudent doctor should have been able to see the error. But other than that, as for example in the operating room, the surgeon is not liable generally for the wrong of an anesthetist because he's an independent contractor. Now, if I'm dealing with an outside computer, unless I have some reason to know that the result is utterly bizarre, then the injured patient can only look to the computer and its people for civil redress, whether, as I say, it's the programmer or the manufacturer or the key punch operator or whatever you have. It's somewhere over there that the wrong has been done.
As a practical matter, if it happens inside the hospital, it doesn't make any difference whether it's the doctor or a hospital employee who's involved. The hospital always gets sued.
Right. That's there's another reason for that, though.
We have one in the front here.
My name is Carl Hoquist. I'm with Aerojet General in Azusa. I posed my comments and question to the panel in general. Some background first. My experience is a little bit variant from everyone's in this room, I suspect, with a bachelor's in math and industrial engineering and a master's in systems engineering and 15 years aerospace experience. You don't come across this too much. Top of that, some business application experience. With this background, I've made some observations on the point of verifying that the computer program does what it's supposed to do. There's a thing in the business world called auditing of the computer program. Accountants do this. They have their own people go in and say to the person who has his accounting system automated, we want to test your system so that we can say to the government or whoever might be interested that you computed correctly. And so they test it, and they verify that it does do its job. In my business, we have very extensive testing to show that the product, the hardware software product, and I've spent many years with computers, does meet the specification requirements. It's going to do the job that it's designed and contracted to do.
Do you have a question you can put to the panel here?
Well, the question is basically this. I feel that, and I would like to have the response, I feel that we are not talking today about a sufficiently staffed team of people to develop these systems. The staff should include doctors and lawyers with cross experience in computer systems. We have some of that apparent here today. We want to have people that might have been called human factors people or industrial engineers that can design systems more readily for the human being than a computer science major type that has spent his time with a manufacturer supplied I/O equipment selections and computers. We want to have people that are not of the classical variety to solve these problems, and I don't see where we are really going in that direction today to get these people in this environment.
Would any of the speakers...
Let me start off the answer. If I understood the first part of your question, and again I have to say I barely know what the words mean, but if I understood the first part, it is that the computer isn't ever wrong. Well, if that's okay, then that's fine. I mean, if you can come in and do these tests for the IRS and they're satisfied that it always reads out right, then that's great, but it was my understanding that isn't true. But again, maybe, as for the second part, I agree with you. I'm equally in favor of motherhood and the other thing they isn't too popular these days, but I'm in favor of that as well.
Would any of the other speakers like to address the question?
I think there are two things here. One is the reliability of the computer and the, say, the programming language and so forth, which I agree, can be checked and tested and so forth and gotten to a point of good reliability such that if it fails, everyone will know it's failed. The other, much more difficult one, is validating the medical content of the particular system, and this gets us rather quickly into the whole area of evaluating the quality of medical care generally, and this is a major dilemma facing all of us, and there are no quick answers.
Do we have any further questions? Gentleman in the back. Yeah. Right there.
Dr. Gary Stein. I'm sorry, did you have a... Dr. Stein from Case Western Reserve Medical School. I was wondering if either Dr. Grossman or Dr. Slack would like to address themselves to a question of, given the context that we are in a changing system, that there is a certain amount of flexibility on the part of physicians who are already in practice, and certainly presumably more flexibility on the part of physicians currently being trained and potential physicians, what do you think is the role of the medical schools now, and what is the appropriate in instructing medical students and future practitioners about the potential or the ways or the proper ways to use computers, and what do you think is what should be taught to medical students nowadays from the standpoint of allowing them to interface perhaps more appropriately or more effectively in the future.
You want to address that to any particular speaker?
It's my own feeling that in terms of the practice of medicine, the working computer system should be so good that it's that the doctor can master it very quickly. And I have my own opinion is that medical school is already overloaded with things of questionable pragmatic value in the practice of medicine, and my leaning is towards shortening the medical school curriculum significantly. And I don't think certainly computer medicine is an important, I think, legitimate field of research, just as is molecular biology for the doctor. And if he wants to pursue this, fine, the avenue should be left open. But I don't think it should become part of a mandatory, or become mandatory as part of this program.
I agree with Dr. Slack. I'd just like to comment on another aspect of that, and that is as data becomes available through computer systems, readily available, the balance of what is taught about medical knowledge in medical schools will need to change appropriately. When certain factual knowledge that is presently memorized by students will be readily available to him, then perhaps we'll need to drop that from the normal mode of operation in medical schools, and I think that's probably an equally important issue as we go along in developing techniques.
Let's see, we have a gentleman over here.
John Silver from San Diego. I have a quick question for Dr. Lamson. You asked that we should, in data input, the data input problem, that we should select the sort of data that the physician wants and put it in a format that he desires. We just finished putting together two multiphasic screening centers in San Diego in an automated lab, and I just have to ask, what doctor? what doctor's wishes.
I'm not sure I understand you. When I speak, I'm forced to speak from my own experience, which is that of a single institution that has a staff of around 1,000 doctors, and I'm talking about that 1,000. Now, I presume you're talking about those with whom you interface with.
Not 1,000, but 50, sir. Yeah. Each one having their own particular viewpoint about how that data should be. I think Dr. Grossman touched on that, too. It's been an interesting experience.
But that's the way the world is, and in some way you don't have the monolithic NASA or government, and you're going to have to learn to deal with that. I think that transportation in urban and government systems, that's, we've changed the name of the game. It's dreadfully hard. That's right. He perhaps is. We don't have an absolute set of medical standards that says this is the data one needs. We don't know enough to know that.
I can tell you how one would proceed in the type of institution in which I'm associated. My hands are tied unless I can gain a consensus somewhere. I can't automate the medical input in internal medicine or obstetrics, but the minute there is a majority group or a persuasive group who are willing to go to bat and say, I think we can do this better, will you help us? And if you will, we'll guarantee we'll use it. Then we get down together and get on with it. And if it's any good, the rest of them will pick it up. If it isn't any good, it'll die a natural death. And that's about the only way in a practical world that I can make progress.
Maybe if the question, if I might just make a comment of my own, if the question is really one of data output, the end product that the doctor uses, maybe the question is a common database, but a variety of data outputs, and that a tailored system, if you will.
I'd like to make one more comment along that line, since I was the first speaker and may have possibly left you with a feeling that I was somewhat pessimistic about our achievements over the last 10 years and where we were going. I'm not terribly proud of what we've accomplished in the 10 years, but I think there's nowhere to go but up. The computer is here to stay, and it's a part of medical practice right now, although a lot of us don't recognize this yet. And in our own institution, the problem is no longer trying to find this consensus so that you can make headway, but to set reasonable priorities so that you pick the most important task first. The simplest problems are complex, and they take a long time, and they're expensive. And we try very hard to have a low failure rate and not embark upon projects unless it's quite evident that we can succeed and that they will be accepted and that they will be useful. And the backlog of such projects is rather high now, and it's our own abilities. Here we touch on the comments made by the speaker in the front row. It's our own ability to put together the right team and know-how that is our limiting factor at the present time. I think the question of physician acceptance is really behind us. I made the comments I did just to dispel, I hope, once and for all, the thought that you design an input instrument that makes sense from the technology point of view, and then the physician had darn well better use it. That's not the way you get the job done.
I think we may have time for one or two more questions. Gentleman in the back over there.
Smoot Horsley from Seattle. Dr. Slack, how do you see the cost of acquiring medical histories via the computer versus the cost via the physician?
Obviously a very important question, and at the same time very difficult to answer. With our computer system at the University of Wisconsin, we felt that the hardware costs per hour on a 40-hour a week basis were in the range of $350, $4 per terminal. And with a history averaging around 30 minutes, about half that, not counting personnel, and of course not development costs, but they should be buried now. Since we began with this work, there's been quite an interest in industry, and there are, I think, something like 12 to 14 companies now marketing computer-based or automated medical histories, interactive-type histories. And it's still pretty much a no-business, as I understand it, but Metadata Systems, Cyril Pharmaceutical Company, is marketing one, and I think they're charging, I think it varies a bit, but around $7 or $8 a history, perhaps less in some areas. I would like to see the cost get down in the range of $1 to $2 a history, something like that. But it certainly is competitive with laboratory tests already, like a BUN of $2, $2 or $3, things of that order. And I think significantly less expensive than the physician.
All right, maybe one more gentleman here in the front.
Ports of Seattle. I was wondering what kind of interchange you've had in software between organizations, or is the software that you have been only within your own hospitals and contained there?
Jerry should respond to that too. We differentiate between computer software and the clinical logic or whatever. Certainly our computer driver, the interviewing programs and so forth, is restricted to our particular hardware configuration. We programmed it machine language-wise. But the clinical logic, the medical history logic, the branching logic and so forth has been put into a number of different computer systems.
In our institution, we have confined ourselves to the use of standard software in all respects with respect to the management of the computing facility itself, for the very reason that we wish to concentrate in the data collecting area and not compete with institutions who are more had more expertise than we in computing technology. Now, when you come to application programming and you start to try to share it between institutions, it is not easy. And you know, I'm sure most of you know what the problems are here. The database will vary from one institution to another. And when you get down to the point of trying to modify somebody else's program, you often find it's cheaper in the long run just to recode it, providing the systems upon which it's based are well-grounded, well-tested, successful, and there's no risk involved. Now, as a member of the University of California family, we are working together, the three hospitals in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Diego, to share programs everywhere we can, and we think we will be able to share financial package programs of that type without too much difficulty. In other fields, I think this is, I'm skeptical as to whether this is even wise at this stage of the game. In a field developing so rapidly as this, if you standardize too much and freeze in on a certain set of programs, then we're all, progress stops in that area until it comes up again to top priority.
As I mentioned earlier, at the MGH, we developed our own system, operating system, and own language, high-level interpretive language, called MUMPS. It is now being marketed by a number of commercial firms so that it is available. But we've done all our own programming in our own language.
I believe that that brings us up to the scheduled closing time for the session. I want to thank you all for attendance, and I want to thank the speakers for what I think is an outstanding session. Thank you very much. I've been asked to make one last announcement on the cards. If you'll complete the cards, the questionnaire cards, if you haven't done so, and drop them at the door on the way out. Thank you very much.